Yes, and one important note about the slides, they are only for like for the citations, so it's not not everything else, it's just for the citations. And I try to have a couple of German quotes, and I try to translate them, and you can like look on it where it fits. So the title of my talk was changed to Normative Claims, Aesthetic Practices, Failure, and the Question of Evaluation, because I focus on failure in aesthetic practices. So I'm just beginning. Aesthetic phenomena can be located in a status of in-between. Between epistemic and teleologically, orientations, everyday life and art. The status is rooted in the aesthetic dimension, actualizing how human beings immerse themselves in the world. There's a tradition in Western philosophy to separate this capacity, which can be linked to the separation of art and is not necessarily rooted in the nature of aesthetic processes as such. My approach is directed towards characterizing the aesthetic as special in the sense not of isolation, but of being irreducibly connected to other orientations. This status can be illustrated with everyday speech and its common sense use of the term aesthetic. Like, this kitchen is very aesthetic, or this building has a very unique aesthetic. This use is often related to distinguishing certain capacities of objects from other, especially functionalist ones. These capacities are not just identified with being useless. Instead, aesthetic seems to mark a presence that oscillates between being superfluous or leftover and providing a sensuous interaction with the world, thereby mediating one's own embeddedness to experience qualities. This oscillation itself radiates a quality of strangeness that shows in the usage of the term aesthetic. Something is somehow interesting but cannot fully be described by other words. Furthermore, the term aesthetic has both positive and negative connotations here. This is mainly due to the fact that aesthetic phenomena are connected to other non-aesthetic circumstances. They can enhance, but also irritate and therefore appear in favorable or non-favorable light. Hence, statements like this surface is only aesthetically pleasing can be found too. Variations of this oscillation between being part of regular epistemic or teleological orientations and exceeding them can also be found in the tensions between art and everyday life. I will come back to this distinction in the context of another implication of the attribution of positive and negative qualities. The aim of my talk lies in inquiring into the implications of the in-between status of the aesthetic for normative questions about its broader relevance for human beings. Framing aesthetic phenomena in a normative way is facilitated by determining them in terms of agency and practice, since these processes can be determined as right or wrong, good or bad. This also means it becomes possible to relate aesthetic phenomena to human striving for being at home in the world and creating a meaningful life with others. This enables evaluating aesthetic practices in ethical terms like emancipation, progress, or togetherness. Due to their in-between status, however, these practices resist being reduced to steps towards ethical ends, since they cannot be immersed into the practical orientation. They remain strange and therefore confront their agents with potentials and limits. Against this background, the talk argues that aesthetic practices provide ethical impulses, but not through harmonious fusions. Instead, they provide being confronted with oneself without security about its outcome. Aesthetic practices irritate teleological organization and thereby are able to actualize frustration and disempowerment through failure. This places them in living reality where striving can be put into action but also can lead to existential dismay. Here, aesthetic practices can be evaluated in their potential to confront their agents with the limitations of their ethical orientations, to open up a broader approach towards what the latter might be, and to remain strange. Finally, I argue for integrating this framework to do the situatedness of aesthetic practice justice. To develop my argument, in the second part, I will present thoughts about comprehending the aesthetic dimension in practical terms. In the third part, the relevance of negative effects of aesthetic practices are discussed with a focus on failure. The fourth part connects these ideas with ethical ideas about being confronted with oneself and others through practice. This brings me to the second part, experience in normativity, aesthetic practices. I will explore briefly aesthetic practice in two directions. First, with regard to a certain attitude towards aesthetic matters. Second, with regard to the nature of these matters. Concerning the first point, my approach is led by an interest in how the aesthetic dimension can be philosophically apprehended without reducing it neither to discursive patterns nor to an assemblage of relativistic positioning, withstanding the pitfalls both of analytic and postmodern aesthetics. Against this background, I aim for a point of view that takes the aesthetic into account from a practice-oriented perspective, which continuously tries to integrate the open-endedness and constructed character and experientially indeterminacy of the aesthetic dimension. This also means that the aesthetic is positioned in a related distance, not too far away and not too close to the philosophical activity itself. The latter is mostly modeled after an epistemic orientation. Hence, a too narrow relation between the philosophical and the aesthetic leads to a reductive epistemic integration of the latter, as in framing it as a perfect form of sensuous insight, as it has been done a lot of times. To achieve the right amount of distance, one should acknowledge how the amount of distance performatively determines the way the object of aesthetic conceptualization is taken into view. This becomes apparent when framing aesthetic phenomena with a philosophical commitment to rationality. Following Kant and Habermas, some philosophical approaches try to isolate the aesthetic dimension as being a rationality besides epistemic or, for example, moral ones. Such an isolation is said to preserve the autonomy of aesthetic phenomena, while keeping it open to philosophical appropriation. This, however, comes with a price. Framing the aesthetic realm from the safe distance of a conceptual analytical point of view struggles with its ongoing and open-ended modification. In this modification, qualitative richness and social-cultural conditionalities are intertwined again and again in new ways. To comprehend their interdependence, two methodological attitudes can be followed. First, a balance between linguistic analysis and mediating aesthetic impressions and expressions can integrate qualitative aspects into philosophical prose. A famous example is found in Adorno's aesthetic theory, where conceptual analysis are combined with figurative speech through mimesis. Second, one can acknowledge the entanglement by embedding the aesthetic in other dimensions of human life. Today, by contrast, cultural space and historical time are parameters of any aesthetic experience. So philosophical aesthetics would have to take a much more general approach. For instance, by attempting to develop the model of an aesthetic practice in which perceptual, cognitive, and moral processes can be treated as equally as sources of aesthetic experience and judgment. Such an integrative approach towards the aesthetic dimension supports my aim to comprehend the normative connections of aesthetic processes. My conceptual focus points are experience and engagement. My aim, however, is not to claim that only subjective attitudes matter. What one experiences aesthetically depends not only on an aesthetic attitude of the subject, but to a very decisive degree also on the perceptual phenomena themselves. The ongoing change of our world modifies the aesthetic field and therefore also determines the subjective framework of experience. Hence, the subjective dimension of aesthetic processes does not have a fixed meaning from the beginning, but is a placeholder that has to be concretized by working through the contemporary landscape of aesthetic phenomena. Furthermore, when talking about aesthetic experience, I do not mean the mainly Kantian conception focusing on an abstract joining of imagination, sensibility, and self-determined taste. Rather, my experiential frame is influenced by John Dewey. He brings the aesthetic dimension into view from inside the human experience as agents constantly interacting with the inner and outer world both in passive and proactive ways. This characterization of experience is directed towards process and practice instead of the post-contemplation. Here, the aesthetic dimension comes into view not as something human beings are thrown into, but as something they construct and create themselves. Aesthetic experience is brought into the world through bodily commitment actualized in agency and labor. At the same time, it becomes fragile, being dependent on unreliably conditioned subjects. Such a characterization has the advantage to unite productive and receptive aspects. On the other hand, it seems to neglect aesthetic experiences of nature. Leaving discussions about the man-made status of nature aside, I want to address this claim only briefly in the following way. Not every aesthetic engagement has to start with something entirely self-made, but everyone has some involvement with the practical capacities of the subject. Even aesthetic experiences engaged with nature can be framed as situations in which the subject has brought herself in. In any case, the focus on comprehending the aesthetic dimension in practical terms is rooted in embedding it in the consummation of life practices and not in limiting it to the cases of unequivocal creation. This discussion brings the nature of aesthetic objects and therefore the question of form into view. Aesthetic objects confront human beings with a certain gestalt that contains and produces meaning and the so-called aboutness. In order to avoid an excessive formalism, it makes sense to emphasize the interplay between subject and object with the help of two distinctions. First, the scope and formal qualities of the aesthetic dimension can be enlightened by exploring the differences between artistic and aesthetic processes, where this exploration is dependent on integrating the social status of the engaged subject. Second, form is a term that cannot only be ascribed to objects, but also to subjects. By creating and engaging with aesthetic processes, subjects are able to develop an attitude or ethos that has a certain form, an aesthetically amplified scope of actualizing oneself. Before I can explore this thought further, I have to introduce a third term, but it's not in my focus, it's judgment. Aesthetic engagements are not neutral. The subjects have motivational relations to them and therefore evaluate them. This brings me to normativity and its relation to framing the aesthetic as practical dimension. If aesthetic processes are majorly connected to human agency, they can be evaluated with regard to their results. When comprehending the normative relevance of aesthetic engagements for human beings trying to become at home in the world, three points come into view. First, aesthetic experience, understood as engaged practice, does not simply happen, but is developed in an ongoing learning process. That the human capacity for aesthetic experience does not simply exist, but that it is only formed in a particular cultural practice. Second, this process happens in fragile balance between individuals and societal circumstances, where ideas about what counts as valuable practice are constantly changing. Third, this has consequences for the engaged subject in an aesthetic and ethical sense. Hence, an exploration of the normative relevance of aesthetic engagements is relevant for understanding human striving. My aim lies in connecting aesthetic terms like intensity and open-endedness with characteristics on the border between aesthetical and ethical terms like truthfulness, leniency, and curiosity. I'm looking for implications pointing towards aesthetic engagement in its full activity and passivity combining form determines an individual ethos. Aiming at not reducing one realm to another, this is not about ethical optimization through aesthetic excellence. Instead, I focus on failure, since this gains a unique presence in aesthetic engagement that withstand a reduction to ethical premises. To what use for the aesthetic dimension as such is this exploration of failure? This question leads to autonomy. According to my view, the aesthetic realm per se is not autonomous. Aesthetic practices can actualize autonomy, but not in an automatic way. As in the ethical realm, autonomy understood as freedom to strive for self-determined realization has to be worked out under ever-changing circumstances. Critical theory does this justice with its materialist anchoring of aesthetic phenomena in situatedness. This also means that to understand the aesthetic dimension, one has to explore the conditions under which they are brought about by ordinary people. With regard to subjective perspectives constituted through active and passive attitudes, this also means to comprehend aesthetic practices as results of struggles and conflicts, to which I will now turn. My turn to failure focuses on three points. First, failure belongs to the aesthetic dimension through its practical framing. Second, aesthetic failure has become a topic through associating art with negativity. Third, the avant-garde of the 20th century show the potential to stage failure, mediating new insights about it. Coming to the first part, failure is part of human factors since human beings are not perfect machines. While errors are something that can happen to defect machines too, mistakes presuppose human beings that are able to understand and break rules. That errors are deviations for which no one is responsible, while by mistakes a presupposed rule or norm is violated. The distinction between errors and mistakes points towards control. Mistakes imply that the agent and principal could have avoided them due to her capacity to control the situation. On first glance, this factor also distinguishes mistakes from failure. It is important in this context to distinguish the notion of failure, not managing to accomplish something from that of mistake, for example, doing something wrong. However, this distinction can be seen as less clear-cut. Failure and mistake are not to be considered as two disconnected categories altogether. Rather, we can see a continuum between those two poles, depending on whether or not we attribute to a subject to counterfactual controllability and therefore responsibility of the contingency that then generates the failure and mistake. Failure goes beyond the control of its agents, at least to a certain extent. But it can nevertheless lead to evaluations. Failure is not only due to a certain attention or act, but to circumstances or the open-endedness of the act itself. Something is not completed successfully. It points towards the processual nature of human agency and to its bigger structures. It is possible to fail in living a certain life. Since failure does not automatically reveal what went wrong, it can open up interpretations according to which the failed process might lead to another success, and hence the original norms appear fragile and relative. This ambiguous nature makes failure interesting for aesthetic theory and practice. This can take the shape of characterizing the aesthetic dimension as withstanding epistemic comprehension, therefore leading to experientially mediated failure of understanding, as Christoph Mengel, for example, developed a theory about. Another case can be found in the aesthetic theory of Adorno, who assigns art a fundamental failure that is rooted in its societal conditionality. Here, artworks resulting from late modernity can aim at authenticity, but at this time, to fail. Such a notion of authenticity, however, leads to failure, according to Adorno, a kind of failure which comes from the impossibility of succeeding in the task to be faced, a task which must be undertaken nevertheless. This failure is rooted in an impossibility to unite. A work of art is great when it registers a failed attempt to reconcile objective antinomies. That is its truth and its success, to have come up against its own limit. Art actualizes a disintegrity of the whole in its parts, subjectivity and objectivity, that rises from an instrumentalist development of enlightenment. Normative claims play a major role here. Artworks aim at utopist ideas of human life, but as results of actual human practice, they fail in truly embodying what could lead to another social and ethical practice. From Adorno's dialectic perspective, they can only refer to this possibility by negating the existing conditions and therefore their own material framework. Aesthetic failure can also be traced to the ways aesthetic phenomena take place. When it comes to artistic practice, failure is embedded in developing one's skills and status as an artist. Hence, there's a tradition in art to treat failure as a form of performative self-reflection. This led to an aesthetic of failure that can be defined as the ways artists reflexively quote and misuse the programmed aspects of their medium. The discussion of this phenomenon points beyond the context of professionalized art practice. First, failure is performed rather than talked about, and then this ultimately lies in specific aesthetic value. Second, a crucial point here is the fact that anxiety about the risk of failure in the artistic process is not attenuated by an open attitude towards the idea of creative error, but is actually intensified by it. In these two points, the openness of failure gains an autonomous presence as experiential quality that can be connected with the mentioned general ambiguity of failure. Indeed, the understanding of what we do is often revealed primarily through mistakes, deviations from what had initially seemed to us to be the right or normal thing to do. This is not only true for mistakes, but also for broader phenomena like failure. Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores, two artists, argue that breakdowns serve an extremely important cognitive function, revealing to us the nature of our practices and equipment, making them present to hand to us, perhaps for the first time. This relativity is fundamentally bound to the relationality of failure. Normative descriptions of success and failure are dependent on interpersonal conditions. It also depends on the social circumstances, whether it is possible to live through the presence of practice failure and learn from it. To educate oneself about the world and to learn about the world requires a learning environment that does not sanction making mistakes. One example for this is that marginalized groups do not get the same tolerance when failing compared to people representing the status quo. Referring to the social context leads back to the aesthetic realm. If one keeps in mind that the distinction between professional artistic and a broader understanding of aesthetic practice is relative to social descriptions, it becomes possible to formulate the following hypothesis. Aesthetic failure can have a normative relevance with regard to human agency, constituting an individual ethos not only through the reception of artistic thematizations, but also to practicing it her or himself. This thought connects to the previous part of my talk. Aesthetic practice in a broader sense involves active and passive dimensions, is intertwined with other forms of human practice, and involves mistakes and failure. Bringing this together with the aesthetic dimension going beyond epistemic and teleological orientations and focusing on a sensuous connection to the world, I want to name a couple of examples. Drawing, crafting, writing letters, prose and blogs, creating a home or garden for oneself and others. This list can be extended and is shaped not only by success in aesthetic terms like intensity, richness or openness, but also by the possibilities of failure. Aesthetic practices in this broader sense have the potential to challenge their agents in unforeseen ways. First, failure in aesthetic practice does not have the same access to techniques of problem solving as epistemic and teleological orientations. The openness and irreducible dependency to non-linguistic dimensions enable progress, but they offer no guarantee for success or linear improvement. Instead, failure in creating something meaningful through material form puts definite limits to intentional control. These limits gain a presence through coming to realize that something went wrong. Feeling paper, paint, letters, soil, space, and light crumble between one's fingers, or taking shapes that remain tilted and distorted without revealing in which way exactly one has failed. Furthermore, as aesthetic agents and creators, we can never be entirely sure if we truly failed at all, since the rules of success are often so deeply entangled in the thicket of subjective preferences, internalized social standards, and interpersonal commitments that we are not able to get a neutral point of view. At this point, aesthetic acts seem to oscillate between success and failure, whereby this oscillation gains another presence already mentioned, between failure as aesthetic event and failure as a disruption of aesthetic events. The strategy of coping with failure by staging, in turn, can be linked to dynamics of modernity concerning the aesthetic agent as subject. Powers of capitalist liberalism have managed to invoke a strong current of individualism that leaves the modern subject in a state of permanent responsibility for choosing between a multiplicity of ways to create herself, combined with no orientation to how to create a meaningful life against the odds of an accelerated environment. According to some theorists, this had led to a rise of dilettantism describing the status of having to create all kinds of practices without really having the capacities to master them. He is a dilettante in crucial matters because he must try, that is, act without having sovereignty. This characterization is relevant for my argumentation in two ways. First, the situation concerns human behavior as such, connecting its different dimensions. Second, it can be evaluated both in negative and positive ways. Reichenbach, for example, explains its negative status by referring to its social devaluation. Dilettantism is not always free of embarrassment. He challenges this status quo, however, with a hypothesis that dilettantism presents an ethos that stays conscious about its own fallibility and inability by trying to enact one's own, oscillating between actively claiming for control and passively agreeing to let things happen through aiming for something one does not master. In this context, failure can be assigned a major role as a dynamic that brings active and passive aspects to life. By oscillating between actualizing, performing, and thematizing failure, the aesthetic dimension creates a space where the acting subject can come to new terms with her constitution by experiencing her scope of interacting with the world and failing to do so. But what is the normative framework for this process? I refer to a part of this workshop's title here, Transformation. Aesthetic practice can create an impact beyond its limits through failure if it transforms the subject's experience and not just leaves it in the same scope as before. The latter happens when failure is idealized, for example, by joining aesthetic norms of intensity and philosophical ideals of transparency in a picture of wallowing in conflict. Here the scope stays the same, everything is mapped out, and lines are charted in the same patterns as before. But what can be the alternative? In Average Priest's book about experimental music, the author explores a unique risk of failure coming to full effect in aesthetic processes. The indulgence of living in failures, contradictions, is a gamble that risks both exile into its own emptiness and an annihilation by its own excesses. The emptiness gains a unique force in aesthetic practices, not only due to its experiential qualities, but because it catches the subject in her core. This is due to the combination of the withstanding character of the aesthetic dimension, a loss of control, like present in the mentioned threatening phenomenon, of effects of failure persisting despite an open attitude towards it, and an intimate connection between subject and practice. The latter can be described with a process of identification that is not an exercise of control, but of putting something of oneself into practice, which names the forming of the subject mentioned in the previous part of my talk. This relationship comes to a halt in failure since this hits the extension of the self. The hit is amplified by the emptiness that is able to suck the subject into a dimension of nothing makes sense anymore, which can turn out as I do not make sense anymore. Taking into account from a broader aesthetic perspective, this disruption contaminates other orientations too. All of this sounds more like a distraction than transformation. How is it possible to attune to this failure without neither falling into idealization nor in despair? An opportunity for an alternative lies in the human capacity to bring oneself into a critical relation to oneself, reaching beyond. Only I myself can ask of myself, and only of myself, more than I am able. Aesthetic failure redirects our attention to ourselves as constantly externalized beings with shape and scope, over which we only have limited control, but which we can nevertheless form through our ethos. However, through mediating the lingering risk of falling into an abyss of emptiness and fragility, aesthetic failure reminds us of understanding this ethos not exclusively in terms of truthfulness, curiosity, and leniency towards one's capacities. In order to come to terms with failure, we have to befriend the embarrassment of our own dilettantism, both as aesthetic agent, as a subject. This brings me to the closure of my talk, the importance of being put in place, ethical implications. The localization of aesthetic failure in a broad picture of aesthetic practices has led to insights about the aesthetic dimension overlapping with dynamics of subjective self-exploration. This points towards a processual framing of making oneself at home in the world. Such a positioning combines insights of action theory, for example, with the ones of postmodern and critical theory, and can be found in so different authors like Mariah Shackman, Judith Butler, Amy Allen, and so on. This processual embedding makes it possible to focus situatedness. Errors and failure, in turn, shape our situatedness by showing us in a performative way that there is no way out from an endless process of trying ourselves. Against this background, it becomes possible to install a more rich ethos that binds self-formation to self-interruption, as it's done by Jonathan Deere, for example. Here, failure serves as a reminder that ignites irritation and this transformation and actualizes relations to freedom and autonomy. They must decide or act without being able to know whether they are doing the right thing. Such doing is called trying. This is the dilettante activity par excellence, the activity of overstrained human being practicing this freedom. One might think that the aesthetic dimension only has an illustrative function here. This impression can be countered with 2 points. First, aesthetic failure is able to actualize a haunting space of threatening emptiness, while at the same time uncover what it means to change one's scope in interacting with the world. Second, aesthetic failure points towards an entanglement of individual determination and social conditionality with its own normative gestalt. In aesthetic practices, failure's social dependence takes a unique form. A deep divide can open up between artistic professionals and aesthetic dilettantes. This has an effect on failure too. He is in a condition of failing despite effort, like in the self-defeating performances of the conceptual artist. Yet, here, there is the difference that failure is not acknowledged as such as in the artist's practice, but is deceptively reframed as personal mistake. So time and time again, painful combination of sensuous richness and the identification of oneself with one's aesthetic labor, aesthetic failure has the capacity to performatively mediate that individual striving depends on the embarrassment of dilettantism, not being met with exclusion, but with encouragement. It depends on our social situation whether we are able to comprehend the transforming capacities of aesthetic practices. This combination of individual and social containment and leniency towards failure has implications for comprehensive questions regarding human life. It can be connected to moral and political questions. Here it becomes clear that the aesthetic dimension, with its indecisiveness between constructive and destructive aspects, is necessary to determine the normative implications of failure beyond the aesthetic realm. Failing as an aesthetic category acquires a redeeming existential quality with a significant human and social message, yet a message that, as we have seen in its contemporary misinterpretations, likewise remains exposed to the risk of not succeeding. Aesthetic failure opens up ethical implications that remain invisible in their effective force, as in the case of embarrassment, otherwise. Hence, failure also enhances the methodological point of, as Truett says, to regard social philosophy as part of aesthetics instead of the other way around. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.